This is DMOU, Destination Marketing Organization University, the DMO Sectors Podcast, and I'm your host, Bill Geist. DMOU is where you hear the best and the brightest in the destination marketing space, sharing innovative and compelling stories to inspire you to take your destination and organization to the next level. The format for our conversations on DMOU is elegantly simple. It's three questions and a bonus round. And today's episode is sponsored by our friends at Destinations International, where you can connect, learn, and lead. Destinations International brings together the brightest minds in the travel and tourism industry, from their annual convention, for which registration has just opened, to specialized summits. These events are designed to inspire innovation, facilitate networking, and provide you with the tools you need to lead your destination into the future. Learn more at destinationsinternational.org/upcoming-events. And now it's on to our show. Ed Tomasi is a esports industry luminary with over 20 years of global field experience. A former senior executive at ESL Gaming, now ESL Faceit Group, Ed is a leading esports advisor for tourism, government, and educational institutions, helping develop and execute strategies to advance their esports ecosystem and initiatives. Ed also serves as a founding member and co-chair of the Greater Raleigh Esports Local Organizing Committee and serves as a volunteer advisor to the esports program at UNC Charlotte and UNC Wilmington. Ed has recently published an educational course intended to develop tomorrow's local and regional esports industry workforce. Most notably, Ed has helped envision and develop the legislative bill with Representative Jason Sane for the state of North Carolina called the NC Esports Incentive Grant Fund, which was signed into the state's budget in December of 2021 by Governor Cooper, and which is the first statewide program of its kind in the United States, committing over $30 million towards esports and gaming initiatives. Ed Tomasi, welcome to DMOU.
Thank you, Bill. Happy to be here.
So for a lot of us, esports is kind of that distant, cool idea that we've all heard something about, but very few of us have gotten into. But we know there's an opportunity out there. But I think a lot of the people listening to this podcast and a lot of the people that I talk to on a daily basis in the destination marketing field just don't know where to begin. So, you know, unless there are listeners that believe themselves to be experts in this field and are here to fact check you, I'm guessing most listeners are coming to the topic from a number of different levels of knowledge. Set the table for us. Esports, how has it evolved and what are the opportunities before our destinations?
There's a lot to esports, right? This whole ecosystem people talk about, and an ecosystem sometimes gets people nervous, right? Like, well, I don't even know what esports is, nonetheless, an esports ecosystem. And to define it, I would say your esports ecosystem is everything and anything that relates to gaming and competitive gaming, also known as esports. And that could be as simple as a high school program that is now incorporating esports curriculum as well as competition as a club. It could be as organized as a competitive team that has a league, if they're lucky enough to be organized and funded properly. It could also mean that there's collegiate programs within a destination's market that has, you know, believe it or not, like globally top competing teams, and they might be right in their backyard. It also could mean publishers, game publishers. It could mean esports organizers and producers and content influencers. There's a lot to this ecosystem. And at first, I will take everybody back, you know, 20 years, where esports was just getting started in North America. And it looked, if you went to an esports competition, it kind of looked like folding tables amongst a spaghetti wire of networking cables and a lot of people, you know, shouting, and it looked like organized chaos in a way. And that a very young, you know, mindset was running with. Today, it's much different. Those were the roots, and those roots still exist today in the form of what we now call local area network, LAN parties. And a lot of them are organized today and they look somewhat similar. And they might be in a ballroom of a hotel. They might be in a community center. They might be in a VFW hall if the VFW hall has enough power and internet to run the event. But it also looks like stadium events. And, you know, they're filling stadiums like this. You know, the Staples Center was one of the first to host a major global event with, you know, flamethrowers and confetti cannons and, you know, and laser light shows. And a lot of times when you first hear of the word, you know, esports event, a lot of people envision that for their destination. And that's kind of the first thing I speak to destinations about is, what is esports to you and what is it not? The majority of destinations that are out there that are not going to be able to host a major global esports event, well, then why would they want to get into it? Well, and that's sort of where we start, right? Their why, understanding and defining it. So it has evolved from kids playing in the basement, right? You know, and we're decades evolved past that. We are now in the classroom. We are at the university level, from a competitive level, from a student services level, from a research level. You know, recently with the bill that you'd mentioned that I work with Representative Sain on, the state allocated millions of dollars to the UNC school system in the form of a grant to NC State University based here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And they're building out an entire program that's going to be world renowned, from research all the way through for production and job integration, job placement. So it has evolved. It is part of our fabric of our youth. It's part of our fabric of our adults. You know, it spans from 8-year-olds all the way up to 60-year-olds esports today. So, you know, some of these games have been around for over 20 years. So if you think about that, it's not a young person's game only. It's really an economic driver. It's a driver that helps increase your quality of place as a destination. It helps drive visits. For many destinations, it's important to get a grasp of how they are going to activate in the space.
Interesting that you say you've got Staples Center, you've got VFW halls, and everything in between. And I have always thought, and tell me if I'm just crazy here, I have always thought, as I watch mall after mall after mall in America fail, that that center of a two-story mall that is always open air all the way up to the ceiling, usually where the food court is, that that would be the perfect scenario. So you've got fan seating in the upper level looking down on the players on the floor with all kinds of manner of big screens, jumbo screens, showing off both the players, the screens, the competition. I just view malls as perfect for a small to medium-sized destination. If you can get your hands on an old closed mall, wouldn't that be the perfect scenario?
You know, it's ironic that Epic Games, they purchased a sizable amount of real estate in Cary, North Carolina, couple of years ago. You know, what sat there was a soon-to-be abandoned mall, and they purchased this space to be the location of their new world headquarters. So
wow.
I think it's ironic that you talk about this, you know, scenario, and then you see someone like an Epic Games, which is one of the largest publishers in the world, you know, publishers of Fortnite, and they're also owners of Rocket League through an acquisition. So and they also have an engine, a technical engine that many of the top global games are built upon, right? So, I mean, that is one form of venue within a destination that can be turned into an esports arena or esports tournament area. There's a lot of checkboxes, though, and I think that's kind of like where my experience over the past 20 plus years in esports production, from, you know, cutting my teeth on LAN parties at ballrooms and converting them into you know, raw space into a tournament area to then building out ESL Gaming's studios in Burbank. We opened up a total of 4 production studios in Burbank, California, to then producing events at, you know, some of the world's most famous arenas and theaters and stadiums. So they are good, but there's a lot of boxes that need to be checked in order for it, the venue and the destination, to work for an esports tournament producer.
Yeah.
At the smaller scales, there's obviously smaller requirements. The larger scales, there's larger requirements. But regardless of what scale you're at, you're either at the, you know, we call it the small, the medium, the large. It's how I kind of break things up. If you're at the small and the medium level, you still have key components as such as internet and power. So if a venue is available because it's not being utilized and it has like good bones and, you know, a good aesthetic and it's a safe spot and convenient spot, if it doesn't have the power and internet required for these games to be produced, it's not a good scenario, because you don't want to bring everybody there and
right.
all of a sudden you blow, you know, you blow a breaker.
Yeah.
And then you got to reset the game and really the chaos ensues. But
I think for a lot of destinations, especially small and mediums, that may see this as, yeah, it's kind of like any other sports tournament or a major convention or event. I think there's something that you and I talked about when we were prepping this call, and that is that this goes so far beyond the actual gamers, the participants, the competitors. The whole esports ecosystem gets into coders and technicians and, you know, people who are into video. I mean, the footprint that it takes to do this is so large. And as destination marketing organizations begin to realize that our mandate is not heads in beds, but it is definitely economic development and community development, to be an esports hub like you've become in Raleigh then just attracts all this amazing talent to want to locate near you, which gets to workforce development, right?
Absolutely. I work with, you know, Mr. Lauren Gold, yep. who is the executive vice president of Visit Raleigh, and he certainly taught me so much about the DMO space. And that's why I think we've worked together so well over the past 5 years in building the strategy and growing the strategy and elevating it. And everything starts with a visit. And so when we look to host an event, you have to start somewhere. And, you know, we've kind of broken it into simple phases. And when you start, you look at what you have the capacity to host. And when we looked at that initially 5 years ago, we said, actually, we have a lot. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of internet capacity. We've got a lot of great spaces. And they check a lot of boxes. Let's go after these events. And so we went after an event. It was the Ubisoft Rainbow Six Siege tournament. It was their global final, and we won the bid, and we hosted it at the Raleigh Convention Center in downtown. And all of a sudden, all of the elements that we thought were positive, they were recognized by the community, by the fans, by the players, by the publisher, by the production company. And we said to ourselves, we got something here.
Yeah.
With that, we started hearing from our corporate community. You know, we've got a heavy tech community here, a lot of pharma, biopharma, and technology. And they were like, hey, we hear you guys are hosting an esports events. Can we get like some corporate tickets to that? Because a lot of the folks that actually work in the office are gamers. So we'd love to come and support and attend. And all of a sudden things started clicking. We were like, yeah, this goes beyond just hosting and worrying about if we're going to fill up hotel rooms and prime rental rates for our venue. This goes into the fabric of our community. And as we had those conversations and sort of, you know, dug our heels in and started spending resources, you know, time, money, and staff into whether it was research or just conversations with our corporate community and our gaming community, we identified what's called Twitch Raleigh. And they're a bunch of streamers, live streamers that live, work, and play in our destination. And we were like, we didn't even know you guys existed. And they turned around and said, we didn't know you existed. And so right. We're like, well, we need to coexist here. We need to support each other. And that's what we did. We built a framework of support and collaboration amongst our corporate community, our gaming community, our publishers, our venues, and really that's the magic, right? That right there is the secret sauce that, you know, we talk about. We're not just thinking it, we're doing it. And sometimes it takes a little bit more moxie to take that step to do. And we did it, and we were happy we did it. And I think other destinations can kind of look at us and look at our strategy and adapt it towards themselves in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. And that's my next question. So you said there are stages about getting into esports. And I love it that you say that stage zero, which most people start at stage one, stage zero is exemplified by the feeling of I'm late to the party, I'll never catch up. But you say that's not true. How does a destination leader get up to speed at phase zero?
Yeah. So, you know, I was taught early on in my grammar school days that zero is a number.
Yeah.
And so it always stuck with me. Zero is a number. And when a destination prioritizes esports to the point where they're going to dedicate, you know, some resources to explore their why, like why they should get into it and what they should be doing with it, they all have to start at zero. And it sometimes it's intimidating. You know, when you have, say, a smaller market that is in the shadows of a larger market and that market receives all the accolades, it receives, you know, all the direct flights, it receives maybe other major ball and stick sports teams. It's okay to start at zero. It's okay to say, I need to have a conversation for what esports can be for us in our destination. And that can live in sync with other destinations around you. So, you know, what I explain is that not every destination is going to have the ability to host a DreamHack event where you need, like, you know, 300,000 square feet.
Okay.
That's hard. You know, that's hard. That's a big box to check. But
right.
A neighboring destination that may be 30, 45 minutes, an hour away can think about how it integrates its plans and programs and initiatives to feed into those events and work with those organizers that are looking for a connection with the community surrounding their event. At the end of the day, esports producers want to sell out tickets. They want to maximize the attendance so that everything else falls into place. So attendance is both in person and it's also online through live stream broadcasts. And we can get into that in a bit as well, because that's a huge value to a destination, even at the local and regional level. Because live streaming is a production that reaches people that are fans of a community, and the fan base for gaming and esports is global. You know, there's no Raleigh Rainbow Six team, right? There's no Chattanooga Counter-Strike team, right? Fans of the game are all over the place, and they follow professional teams that are based, they might be based in Europe, they might be based in Asia, they might be based in America, but they've got players from all over the world. So it truly is a global sport and a global fan base. It's not regionalized. And that's beneficial to destinations because they're not limited by just what's in their market, right? If you look at like a hockey team or a baseball team, minor league baseball team, like, you know, if you look at the map, okay, what's the radius of your fan base? Well, it's, you know, it might be just drive distance, right? When you bring in live streaming, it instantly goes global, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, just getting back to sort of these phases, you start at zero. I say you start conversations and then you formulate an approach. So that's sort of your initiating phase, which is let's explore this, right? That's your phase zero. Mm-hmm. As you go further into it, you get to sort of a phase one where you're conducting the demand and awareness and feasibility studies. So that's where you're assessing things. And then you get into phase two where I say you start building a plan that is unique and universally valued and visible. So you need people within your market that you're partnered with, and it's not just a transactional relationship. It's more partnership relationship that they value, you value, and it's visible. They know that you're doing this and the reasons why, and they're agreeing with that and supporting that. And then the next phase is sort of the investment, right? So that's where you start dedicating the proper time and resources to execute your strategy. So you go from zero of initiating, you go to one, which is your assessment, you go into this phase two, which is your strategy, and then you go into a phase three, which is the investment. And from the investment, it starts either start diversifying your investment by, you know, having a small, medium, large approach, or maybe you'll never have the large events in your destination. So you're focusing more your investment on your high school and your collegiate, you know, programs, and maybe looking to stand up a parks and rec program.
And let me take that concept of collegiate a step further. And again, you know, talking about the small or medium sized destinations, I mean, you've got colleges and universities, I'm sure, in your region that have created a esports. I mean, you can letter in esports in many of these schools.
Yeah.
And so they're already competing in some way, shape, or form. And just as you say, there's one group that doesn't know the other group is out there that is so endemic of colleges and communities is we don't know that they're already competing in many cases. How do we then take that opportunity and say, hey, can we step in and help and make your competitions that much bigger, that much better, which then brings more attention to their university or college and to our destination? I mean, it's a win-win, right?
It is. And again, it starts at phase zero, start the conversation, you know, pick up the phone, shoot, you know, walk across the street to the campus. Like a couple years ago, when I first started doing advisory work for destinations, one of the steps that I explained is essential is for them to walk into a GameStop.
Okay. Yeah,
because GameStops were all over the place, right? And they still are,
right?
Sure. And I said, do you know who your local and regional experts are? They're behind the counter.
Yeah, right.
Okay?
Yeah.
You're not going to figure this out by yourself, and you need to start that conversation. So, and today I say walk onto campus.
Yeah.
You know, because you're right. We just finished a research project for my advisory firm. And, you know, we were trying to basically put this landscape together for colleges and universities in the state of North Carolina, 2-year, 4-year HBCUs. And if I tell you that esports is the Wild West, collegiate esports is the wild, wild west.
Yeah.
And it's because it's still in its younger phases where, you know, one school in town and the other school on the other side of town, they both have esports clubs or programs, and they're competing in two different leagues.
Yeah.
Well, how is that, right? Well, it's because, like, you know, maybe one has grew out of a club of students that was more into a certain genre of video game title, and therefore the publisher for that video game title has its own collegiate league. So that's the only league that school is really participating in. So it's all these different variables. But what we're finding is that the esports program, and I use the word program because some of them are clubs. Some of them are, like you said, they're varsity sports. Some of them are incorporated into like an official school, like the School of Education or the School of Business. And they have curriculum that they're teaching for workforce development purposes. They're all different phases everywhere you go. What's really interesting is that all of these programs are generally the largest student programs in the school today.
Yeah.
You know, whereas before it might have been intramural basketball that was, everybody's playing intramural basketball, right? Now, the largest groups are the esports clubs or the esports programs. So that's the evolution of esports. And so as a destination, you know, you really, really want to have that conversation and relationship and partnership to support what they're doing, because that could grow into a small in-market collegiate tournament amongst the schools that are within a 30 to 40 mile radius of your destination, into more regional, where now all of a sudden it's like the tri-state area. And now you're hosting it because you've invested your time into the phases of conducting the awareness and demand, building your strategy, and then investing in that strategy. So 2 years ago, it was the room in the library, and now all of a sudden it's the Reynolds Coliseum. It's all just natural because you become a trusted host destination. And that's like the ultimate goal is trust. Like,
yeah,
you have to prove trust. You have to, you know, not just talk the talk, but walk the walk as a destination. And once you do that, that takes you to a whole different level.
Yeah.
The trust level is tremendous in the esports community, especially at the production and publisher perspective. So getting into it for the right reasons, with the right motivations and the right investment, is something that is visible by these folks. And once you gain their trust, you're going to be in it. You're going to be on a nice path to success.
Yeah. And so investment is the perfect segue to your final question. And that is, you told me that one of the most important aspects of entering a market that, while very young, is surprisingly sophisticated, is understanding that this is about venues and investment of resources. Outside of Raleigh, give us some examples of destinations that have done it right, or at least are doing it right as they're feeling their way in the Wild West.
If we were to summarize all of this, there's a lot of resources that are being focused in on youth athletics and even adult athletics and programming for you know, health and wellness. If you incorporate esports into that mix, you're on the right path. And what I mean by that, there are destinations out there that are retrofitting or upfitting or developing new facilities that they're calling multi-sport facilities. Esports should be one of the multi-sports in that, for the consideration. And with that consideration comes the capacity to host these events, and the lifeblood of that starts with power and internet and networking. And then it goes from there. Do you have a practice room that could be dedicated? Do you have flex space that allows you to run a yoga studio day one, and day three, you can turn it into an esports competition area? You know, venues are now looking at that scenario, not building for the sole purpose of esports, but incorporating esports as a multi-sport focus. You look at convention centers that are getting upfitted and retrofitted. You know, a good example of that is down in Arlington, where they had some space that someone early on realized that, you know, Dallas in and of itself is a hub mm-hmm. for esports, and has always okay. been for 20 plus years. They kind of get gaming and esports down there. And then someone, you know, in that space said, oh, you know, you're going to be upfitting this area, just give me X amount of space, I'm going to turn it into an esports arena. You know, that's one example of purpose-built venues, right? Another one up in Cary, they've envisioned a multi-sport indoor facility. One of those sports of the multi is esports. So all those things like practice rooms and enough networking bandwidth to scale up to these events. And it doesn't necessarily mean an existing convention center most likely has enough power. And if it doesn't, it just needs to understand, okay, well, what do I need to bring in temporarily for some of these resources? We have backups of backups, right? And so we talk about dual redundancy, and we talk about flexibility in contracts. And that's really key, because when you're a venue and you're being asked for 10 gigabits for an event, you know, you're lucky if you have one.
Right.
And your contract is usually got annual contracts. Sometimes they're multi-annual, right? And you call up your representative and say, hey, I'm hosting an event, an esports event, and they need 5 gigabits. And what that salesperson does is he turns around or she turns around and sends you a new annual agreement. And you're like, whoa, I don't need this for 365 days. I need this for 10. And so you as a venue, you need to start building those relationships with your service providers so that the needs of esports producers is reflected in the flexibility of your contracts.
Right.
There's a number of properties, hotel properties that I can speak of that have started and had those conversations and those things are in place. I've worked with groups up in Waterloo, Canada. They've identified collegiate esports as the fabric of their region. They do have a publisher up there, a couple of tech companies in Google and Microsoft and Shopify. And those folks want a quality of place where they say, hey, well, let's go over and watch the esports match, you know, next weekend. And like, it's so cool that it's hosted in our town.
Wow.
But from a collegiate perspective, like some of these schools are looking at taking their esports program to a next level that's in line with other athletic programs. So whether it's, you know, specific dorms for the esports players where the, you know, there's 24-hour access or monitored access, or there's just certain benefits of the infrastructure that adheres to the schedules and demands of an esports team player.
Okay.
You know, I'm reading your book. And, you know, one of the things in chapter 6, right off the bat, you said, if a destination is serious about growing its visitor economy, it will need a professional organization to lead that effort. So a lot of destinations believe that, you know, at first when they start at zero, they usually put like the youngest person on the staff in charge, or they'll put their sports people in charge of esports. And there's no wrong approach. But, you know, when you want to get to your whys faster and more accurately with the resources that you have, it's best to look at, you know, look at professionals.
Yeah.
Right. And the professionals are often not within your organization. They're sort of advisors. And then they kind of put training wheels on. And once those training wheels are off, you're off to the races sort of as an organization.
So you clearly are one of the most articulate speakers to this subject and advisors. I've learned a ton just in the two times that we've had the opportunity, both on the prep call and today. If any of our listeners want to go deeper with you on this topic, on the phases, on how they get engaged, and understand that this takes destination leadership to actually break into this market and do it right, how do they find more on you and your services?
You can start by reaching out via LinkedIn. You can reach me at my website, playharder.com, and it's PlayHardr.com. And we can get connected and start the journey.
Cool. So it's time for your bonus round question. You've had a bunch of cool experiences in your life, and we could go a whole bunch of different ways, but my interest was piqued when you told me that you were a cheerleader in college. And that is a story I would love to hear more about.
Yeah, I played sports my entire high school career, a dual sports. I played baseball and football, and I started both as sophomores. So I had a lot of varsity letters and looked to continue my sports career in college, but ended up going to a school that I wasn't looking sort of at seriously to begin with. So I ended up going to the University of Dayton in Ohio, go Flyers.
Yeah.
And so when I went there, I didn't even reach out to the coaches in time for the recruitment sessions for either of the sports. So I walked on, and one of the sports that I walked on was for football, and I made it to the last tryout. It was like a full week of tryouts. And at the end, we were like all in full gear and everything. And so I got cut right at the end there at the last one. And I was like, oh man, like, what am I going to do with my time now?
Yeah.
And literally that night, I think it was, I was down at the gym, and in walks a cheerleader from the squad on her way up to practice. And she knew my roommate. So she said hello and like, oh, you know, she knew I was trying out for football. I think she knew what she was doing. So, and knew where I was to find me. So she's like, hey, listen, like, you know, how'd you do it? And I said, yeah, I didn't make it. I made college. Oh, I'm sorry to hear about it. I heard that Mike made it. Yep. Mike made it. She's like, hey, listen, I know this is probably, you know, a strange question. She's like, but do you want to come up to, you know, the workout room where all the cheerleaders are, because we're starting our, you know, our sessions and our season. I'm like, hey, wait, cheerleading? Like with guys? And she's like, yeah. And she's, I'm like, all right, now you got my interest, you know? And so I literally went up with her, and I remember one of my first visions of cheerleading at the collegiate level, where I saw this 6 foot, 225 pound guy toss this, like, she looked like a gymnast, but she was clearly, like, it, to me, it looked like 100 feet in the air. And I was hooked. I was like, what is this? And so she's like, let me show you how this wall works. And it was really interesting, because it's like, a lot of it's based on, like, you know, the Russian, the circus and all this leverage and whatnot. And it was just fascinating to me and quite the workout. And so, yeah, so I became a varsity cheerleader for the University of Dayton Flyers, and
very cool.
And went to all the home games, and it really was a lot of fun. You know, they become your brothers and sisters, but I think the impact that it had on me was that I can get in front of a 20,000 person crowd,
yeah,
and, you know, right, deliver a message under the spotlights and carry that pride and excitement. And, you know, I think that you could see a little bit, hear a little bit of that when I'm at esports events, whether I'm producing them or whether I'm guiding a destination on how to do them. I'm really like a fan of the destination and really get involved with being a fabric of that community and bringing that community to a common goal. So, you know, it was one of the greatest. I got to travel all over to schools I probably would have never have gone to, gotten on the floor of so many great games, and it was really a special moment. So, yeah, so male cheerleader.
Yeah, I can only imagine that moment where it's probably, what, September, freshman, a cheerleader comes up to you and says, why don't you come and try out for cheerleading? And you're thinking to yourself, wait, I just got invited to go hang out with all those women?
Anyway, it was just a great group, and they're still my best friends till today.
Yeah.
You know, they in them of themselves are innovators and leaders and inspire, you know, so many, either as a teacher,
yeah,
or as a, you know, in Hollywood or whatnot. And, you know, you just, it's funny, we always used to like who else was a cheerleader? Oh, like, you know, George Bush was a cheerleader. And you start looking at all these like people that were cheerleaders, and you're like, wow, okay, well,
yeah,
you know, that's pretty cool that I'm in that company of the people. But you know, we were just
nothing to be embarrassed about.
No, I mean, sure, you know, it was you know, a source of pride, right, to be representing, yeah, our school. And, you know, like I said, we had such a great time, and we worked so hard. We were always, I think, 2 weeks before the football team showed up till well after March Madness was over. I mean, we went through two seasons and practiced, yeah, every single bit of it. So
very, very cool. So again, listeners can find you at playharder.com. And people can also see you coming up in a few weeks at the Esports Travel Summit on May 30th in your hometown of Raleigh, North Carolina. How do they find out more about the Esports Travel Summit?
I think it's esportstravelsummit.com. It's a North Star Media event. And, you know, okay, first day is actually the 29th. And then we get into the, you know, full day of programming on the 30th. And then there's a half a day in the morning on Friday, the 31st. So, yeah, it's going to be really good programming. Raleigh is hosting it for the first time. Myself and Mr. Lauren Gold have been invited by the Esports Travel Summit organizers for the past several years at various different locations for either speaking or paneling or moderating. And this is the first time that we're actually hosting it. So a lot of the programming is really, I'd say, motivated by conversations that we've had with the Esports Travel folks to really, you know,
yeah,
bring a unique element to this year's event in Raleigh. And I think people are going to walk away with a lot of really good go-to and knowledge to do, not just think.
Yeah. Ed, thank you so much for sharing all of your expertise with us. I'm not going to be able to make it to the Esports Travel Summit, but I am sure that many of our listeners will attempt to do that. And I hope that we can cross paths in person down the line.
Yeah, might try to make it to that Destinations International event. That's down in Tampa this year, right?
We are in Tampa in July, so maybe we'll see you there.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks so
All
much,
right.
Bill.
Excellent. Hey, that's it for this edition of DMOU. Tell your friends and peers this is where the best and the brightest come to share their stories. It's DMOU.com, and be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you listen to DMOU to be notified when new episodes drop. Thanks again to our sponsor, our friends at Destinations International, where you can connect, learn, and lead. Destinations International brings together the brightest minds in the travel and tourism industry, from annual convention, which registration has just opened, to the specialized summits. These events are designed to inspire innovation, facilitate networking, and provide you with the tools you need to lead your destination into the future. Learn more at destinationsinternational.org. DMOPros.com is where you're going to find more links to services that we provide to the DMO sector, links to the Z News, position papers on board diversity and a new model for destination development, the book Destination Leadership, and the biggest DMO job board on the planet, plus access to past episodes of DMOU. That's DMOPros with a Z.com. Executive producer of DMOU is Terry White, and this is a production of DMO Pros. I'm your host, Bill Geist. Until next time.